Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 52 of Real Talk. Although for this introduction to my podcast, I'm in my normal office, you will see that in the next couple episodes, I have recorded them in my home office. Why? Because I need to be in close proximity to the baseball fields because it's literally playoff season. I like to tell people that between March 1st and June 1st, I'm full-time baseball coach and part-time lawyer. Well, it's also a lot easier to do that when there aren't that many deals to be done. Orioles, hopefully we can win another World Series. This week, I have Sean Burton, the CEO of CityView, on my show. CityView is one of the largest developers in Los Angeles. Sean is also very politically involved at a local level and national level, having worked in his younger days in the Clinton administration, now with the Biden administration. But his full-time job is CEO of CityView. And we talk about, you know, trends in the multifamily market, how there's seemingly now a return to the coastal markets after several years of many developers wanting to go to the Sun Belt. And we talk about the interplay between real estate and politics. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Sean Burton.
Welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I'm here with my good friend, Sean Burton, CEO of CityView. Sean, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, I know we were talking before, you know, it looks like you're in your office. I'm in my home office. Between March 1st and I would say June 1st, I'm part-time lawyer and full-time Little League coach. So we got a big game. Big game against the Rockies this afternoon, so got to be close to the park.
You got to have your priorities straight. As someone who coached, you know, my son all through Little League and All-Stars, and it's one of the great experiences. So good luck in the game this afternoon. No matter what happens in this podcast, you got the game later.
Appreciate that. So, Sean, for those of my attendees and my listeners who don't know CityView, although I would imagine most do, give an overview on the company.
Yeah, so CityView, we founded it in 2003. So we had our 20-year anniversary at the end of last year. And we are focused exclusively on multifamily, both acquisition and development, and the western half of the country. We're fully vertically integrated. We do all of our own development, construction management. We property manage our projects. And we're focused on, you know, markets where we see really strong housing demand because jobs are growing faster than the rest of the U.S. You know, more people are coming there. Demographics are growing. Incomes are growing faster than the rest of the country. But in places where it's generally difficult to build new product, where there's big kind of barriers to entry. And so that's always been our thesis and what we focused on for the last two decades.
And how, I mean, obviously the last couple of years have been a choppy time in the real estate market. How has deal flow been? What have you guys been doing over, you know, the last couple of years since it's in a rising interest rate environment?
Yeah, I think it's been really challenging the last 2 years to do new deals. You know, we were busy. We have over 50 assets that we own and we manage. We're in the middle of delivering a bunch of developments. You know, we delivered, I don't know, 1,500 units or something last year. So we had lease ups on those. But on the new deal front, you know, we basically, you know, have not done a value add deal, a new one, for almost 2 years. We underwrote over 100 last year and chose to do none of them, to give you a sense. But that being said, we're actually going non-refundable today. I just released contingencies before this call. Andrew, you're familiar with that?
I am.
on a project we're buying up in the Bay Area. So it's the first value add project that we've liked. And we think there's, you know, we're seeing some really interesting movement in the market where people are now kind of forced to sell. A lot of lenders have said, okay, we're not going to extend your loan anymore unless you write a big check. And there's been some reality check on pricing. I think last year there wasn't a reality check on pricing. You saw a lot of people take things to market, test a market, not get the number they want, and then pull back. There was a couple of deals that, you know, we kind of went through best and final, and then the seller pulled it last year. So, you know, we are seeing a, you know, light at the end of the tunnel. But a strategy we do like, and we have been active on, is on land options. We have a number of projects over the last year and a half or so, where we've been able to go in and put land under contract. We're taking it through an entitlement process, and we'll take the land down and buy it once we have our GMP and our permits and everything else and kind of ready to go. And we're doing that in markets where you still have this kind of supply demand imbalance, but where nothing new is being built because development hasn't worked with interest rates. So we're pretty excited about that strategy.
You know, in talking with developers, multifamily developers, you know, they're excited about the prospects of, you know, getting their entitlements, building through this time period, and in a couple of years coming to market where they hope there will be more limited supply. Here's the home line. This is the challenge of working from home.
Maybe somebody's calling with a deal, so we should answer it.
It's possible, yeah. And so the what they perceive as we'll cut that out. Fine. Okay, I'll restart.
You start the question over. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. So Sean, so many of my developer clients are looking at this time period as an opportunity to, like what you were saying, entitle their projects, go through construction, and then ultimately bring a finished product where supply will be more limited. Today you hear, even though we are in a housing crisis, yet at the same time, real estate companies are talking about oversupply.
Right.
What are your thoughts with that thesis?
So it's interesting. We spent a lot of time talking to investors about this and the media. Because if you read the national headlines, they talk about, you know, oversupply of multifamily units. But that's not true in the Western Gateway markets. In fact, there's an article this week about a study that just came out that permits are down 43% in California, right? As an example, new multifamily permits. So yes, in Orlando and Atlanta and Phoenix and these other markets, Austin, you're seeing a bunch of supply being delivered, and that's driving down rents and creating its own challenges. You don't see that in places like Los Angeles. You know, the rule of thumb is generally you want to deliver about 3% of the housing stock every year in order to keep pricing equilibrium. Right. And the reason for that is you have some job growth, you have some, you know, people demographic growth, but you also have obsolescence, certain units that go offline. So 3% is a good balance. In LA, for example, over the next 5 years, we are on track to deliver 0.6%. So 1/5 as much housing as we need just to keep equilibrium. We already have a housing crisis here and a homeless crisis. It's obviously exacerbated by the housing crisis. So I think it's important when investors and others are looking at opportunity and they read these national headlines to really dig into the markets that you're considering and you know, look at the specifics.
You know, although you're located in LA, I would say the vast majority of my clients who are also located in LA have been transacting in markets of Phoenix and Vegas and Texas and Florida and the Carolinas, Atlanta, Nashville, and they went away from the Bay Area and Southern California and LA over the last 4 years. I'm now seeing a pivot where those companies are now coming back to California, whether, you know, both previously it was maybe regulatory reasons, you know, ease to develop in those other markets, but now they're experiencing oversupply in these markets. It seems, I know when you look at the City View website, you know, you are Western focused, but really focused in California. Had you ever moved away from building in California? I mean, what's your view with respect to, I guess, the challenges or doing business in California?
Sure. So, So we are all over the Western states. So we have, we built in Dallas and Phoenix and Denver. We have a bunch of stuff in Denver now and Seattle. So we've been all over those markets and we target those markets now. You know, we're currently entitling almost 1,000 units in Denver, in a great location. You know, Seattle's been a great market over the years. The last couple of years, we've stayed away from it because some oversupply, but it has incredible kind of demand fundamentals. Obviously, the demand story in Texas and Dallas is incredible. Austin's a market we've been in the past. We're not currently there now because we don't like the supply numbers coming in, but that's a market we'll be in the future. So, you know, those are all markets that you know, we believe make sense. I would say our brand is more California because we've done a lot of iconic projects here. And we're obviously, the, you know, the largest developer here in Los Angeles and have been for a while. So people think about us as LA or California only. We're much broader than that when you look at what we own, what we manage, what we built, et cetera. Look, I do think California has its challenges. LA has its challenges. It's interesting. For many years, a lot of investors invested with us because they loved the West Coast and it was hard to access the West Coast. And we had a lot of experience and people said, you know, that's so smart that you're focused on the West Coast for a lot of reasons. Then COVID hit and everybody said, well, you guys are so dumb because you're not in the Sun Belt. Like, why aren't you in the Sun Belt? Everybody's moving to the Sun Belt or to Boise or to Dallas, Florida. Now all this oversupply is coming, everybody's coming back and we're smart again. So it's good to be smart again. You know, we've stayed away from Sunbelt states generally, except for Phoenix and Sunbelt cities because of this low barrier to entry. And we thought about a lot of those markets are kind of trader markets versus owner markets. And what I mean by that is there's certain markets that we believe exhibit long-term fundamentals and there may be ups and downs, but you're going to be on an upward trajectory. And so if you invest in there and you have patient capital, you're going to do well over time. Those are owner markets. Trader markets are markets that you can definitely make money in, but you really got to hit them at the right time. I think Phoenix has been that way. I think Vegas has been that way. Some of those other Sunbelt cities. And depending on when you invest, you could do well or you could not do as well. So, you know, our thesis has always been to focus more on owner markets. And because we have institutional capital, pension funds, and insurance companies and others, we think that's a good match with their kind of longer term focus.
I want to get into, you know, more on the affordability and homelessness issues that obviously affect all of the United States, specifically in LA. But before we get into that, you mentioned the capitalization. And in talking with clients today, it is it's hard to capitalize any type of deal, but it is hard to capitalize ground up construction deals. There's a growing trend from the equity side of why put money into ground up deals when I could buy relatively new vintage multifamily at below replacement cost. How's the market for you in attracting investors?
Yeah, so we've been, you know, fortunate to attract investors. We just closed in December our seventh commingled fund that we've had with a abundance of institutional investors, a couple of family offices. We also have strong joint venture relationships. We've been lucky to have, you know, for the last 15 plus years, we've always had discretionary capital. We've always had more deal flow than discretionary capital. So we've built joint venture relationships with folks like, you know, Blackstone has been a big partner or Clarion or Stockbridge or others and share their, who kind of share our vision on our market. So we've been fortunate in that perspective. I will say that, you know, we agree with the thesis that it doesn't make a lot of sense today to finance a development deal and put a shovel in the ground. Like if you can buy at a significant discount to replacement cost, why would you develop? And so we're completely on that bandwagon, which is why we haven't started a new development in, I think, over a year. And right now our development activities are focused on these land option deals where we're entitling and adding value and doing the plans and permitting. And then we will throw the switch and take down the land and develop once the metrics make sense again. So we love having the flexibility to be able to turn the dials between value add and development and entitlement because it allows us to take advantage of wherever the market is. Our thesis remains the same, which is we want to build in these high demand, low supply markets where there's a lot of energy and interest and where you can maybe outperform over time with your rent growth, et cetera. So we haven't changed our strategy. You just change your kind of timing of what you invest on when based on where the market is and where the opportunities are.
Mm-hmm. And do you have different buckets of capital for each of those programs, whether it's value add versus ground up? I mean, it's very hard to get capital for unentitled land to spec that type of capital.
It is. And we really generally don't buy land unentitled. We'll option it, take it through the process,
right. Okay.
And then buy it. We have taken down unentitled land in the past, but that's not a good fit generally for big institutional clients because it's outside of their kind of risk tolerance, which we understand. And frankly, in this market, because of the attractiveness of, the challenges in the market and the challenges that sellers have faced, you're able to get better terms than you could before. You don't have to take down land in order to take it through an entitlement process. So I think that's an advantage. And, you know, generally it is different buckets of capital. I mean, we are lucky that with our funds, we're able to do both value add and development. And so we can kind of, you know, toggle those dials as we need to. But then on the joint venture side, yeah, there's some investors that, you know, like development risk, and some of them want to do merchant build and where you lease it up and you sell it. Others say, hey, let's hold this for 10 years because this is an incredible location. So we have build to core capital, we have merchant build capital, and then we have separate value add capital, even core plus. You know, we have a couple of core plus strategies where we've done some roll ups of portfolios and targeting kind of a low teens return, low double digit return, taking less risk, and we do that. The only thing we really don't do is focus on acquiring kind of brand new core assets. We have a bunch of core assets we manage. Those are assets that we built and we now manage in a build a core strategy. But generally, if you know you have a brand new building somewhere that's a 2023 build, we're not necessarily the best kind of partner for that, and our capital is not focused on that.
Sure. Now, I want to pivot the conversation, like I was alluding to before, really the interplay between real estate and politics. Like you're in the real estate business, you're probably in the politics business as well. But you're even in the politics even more so than most of my clients that are in the real estate industry. I know you worked in the Clinton administration and President Biden. You're part of the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority. You've been on the board of here of the Airports Commission. I guess my question is, you know, in talking with other real estate owner operators, you know, they feel, if I could put an overgeneralization, that local government looks to real estate and landlords as an avenue to fix a lot of societal issues, right? Mm-hmm. So whether it's school fees and other
homelessness, right? Yeah, the mansion tax,
yeah, everything, and so there is this. I don't want to say hostility, but there's tension. There's tension between the real estate community and local government. How have you been able to just navigate, being in politics, being in the real estate business, trying to bring more product to municipalities when municipalities are making it hard for a lot of real estate owner operators, developers to do their business?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. Obviously, one of the biggest challenges working in LA or California is the regulatory environment and dealing with elected officials and governments. I've had the benefit of working a lot, with governments over the years. As you mentioned, I started my career 21 years old working in the Clinton White House. I've done a number of boards and commissions over the years, as you mentioned. And one of the most valuable is I served for 5 years on the City Planning Commission under Mayor Villaraigosa here. And that was incredibly enlightening because I got to sit on the other side of the table and watch all of the developers come in and land use attorneys and architects. And you really saw the kind of good from the bad. You saw, who really, worked well with a community and understood their issues and designed something that made sense and had a collaborative process and brought in elected officials and brought in community groups. And then you saw others who came in and just tried to jam their vision into a community and it didn't go well. And so that was really helpful from my perspective to learn about what's the right way to work with elected officials, to work with city officials, to talk to neighborhoods about what they want. You still have to design and build a product that's viable, right? It's got to make sense. It's got to be, you know, financeable. But, you know, our thesis is, and because of all the experience we have, we engage early and often with the community. And, you know, we don't think we can get things done that other people can't. I want to be really clear about there's no like secret sauce. But what there is, I think, is, you know, I feel like we were able to make good decisions about what's possible, how to execute. And we say no to a lot of things. I mean, you know, if we early on in our due diligence period before we've gone non-refundable determine that from an entitlement perspective, this isn't going to make sense for some reason, you know, we will not pursue it. Right. And we'll let somebody else pursue it. And you know, we're blessed with a very strong track record on the entitlement front, I think, because of that approach. And I also think it's a competitive advantage for us as a firm. A lot of people have left California, have redlined California, have redlined Los Angeles. And, you know, that creates opportunity for those of us that are still here and know how to work within the system to add value, because the fundamentals are still strong. I mean, you know, people love to bash California and talk about how we are, you know, down the tubes. I mean, you know, in any given day, we're the fourth or fifth largest economy on the globe. You know, we go back and forth with Germany. And by the way, Germany has twice as many people as we do. That means we're twice as productive. You know, you have, you know, Silicon Valley, people come from all over the world to, you know, to be there and be a part of the innovation and the entrepreneurship. You know, LA's got incredible diverse industry and economy that continues to grow. So there's a lot of pluses in the California and LA column. And we think if we can navigate some of the regulatory and political challenges, we can add value for our investors.
Do you have concern of the migration or the exodus of companies from California and Southern California to Texas and other parts of the Sun Belt?
Yeah, we do. I think that's a real issue. And I actually chair Mayor Bass's Executive Business Council. And the purpose of that council and the reason she created it, she said, look, I want people to know LA is open for business. And I want to attract companies, not drive them away. And I want advice from business leaders about what should LA be doing to attract more businesses here? And how do we support those jobs? And how do we retain those jobs? And you know, she said to me, you know, it's very clear to me that the private sector is the job creator, not the public sector. You don't hear a lot of elected officials say that. You don't hear a lot of Democrats say that. Mm-hmm. So I am concerned about that. And I think the number one issue that we can do to actually keep those companies here is to create more, you know, housing. Right. I mean, housing is the big issue. It's the number one issue in surveys when people fill out why they leave. It's because they can't find affordable housing. And then, by the way, that doesn't just mean government subsidized affordable. That means entry level. That means market rate. That means move up. The whole housing spectrum, we need to do a much better job of addressing.
And despite the need for more housing, it's from my perspective and my clients' perspectives, for the most part, it seems like it's just challenging to build and to develop, despite the fact that we need more housing. And it's too easy for a single person to put a significant roadblock into a developer's project.
Yeah. No, it's incredibly challenging. And I was just reading, something on CEQA, right, which California Environmental Quality Act, for your viewers who don't do business in California. And it was interesting, you know, it's totally been hijacked by non-environmental interests.
Sure.
Right? It's just a way to block. And, you know, in 1970, when the national environmental laws were passed, California and other states passed CEQA. By the CEQA was signed by Ronald Reagan. Most people don't know that. And it was intended to say if the government, right, if California builds a project, it should make sure that it's doing it in a way that doesn't harm the environment. And that was the intent. But right after it was signed, some developers tried to build some condos in Mammoth. The local communities, it's a ski town here in California, the local community got together fought it, and they used CEQA to fight it. And the state wasn't worried because they said, well, CEQA only applies to government, you know, government buildings, government development. But the California Supreme Court at the time reinterpreted CEQA to say, well, any government building, like any government approval counts under CEQA. So if you need any sort of permit from the government, you're now under CEQA, which was not the intent. And that's now become the major issue to block, you know, most new development in California. So it's not what it intended. And it's something, frankly, the electeds in Sacramento need to take head on. You don't have to get rid of it, but you need to reform it and get it back to its original intent.
Right. You know, you talked about the red line that certain developers and capital providers and lenders drew through LA. And I feel like the straw that broke the camel's back was the mansion tax in ULA. Yes. I mean, have you seen a noticeable difference in, I guess, your investors' appetite for transacting in LA, knowing that there's going to be a 5.5% surcharge in doing business here?
I think, and I've said this to the mayor and every other elected official who listened to me and to the media, I think the mansion tax is the worst piece of legislation for housing development that I've seen in my career here in California. And that's saying something.
Yeah, I was going to say, that says a lot.
Yeah, that's saying something. I mean, we have seen underwriting for new development virtually stop in California, in Los Angeles. You cannot make the numbers work because I think what a lot of elected officials don't understand is it's not a 5.5% on your profit.
Right.
It's on the gross value. So in a standard deal, that could be 30, 40, 50% of the profit, which makes the deal uneconomic. You could lose money on a project and still pay it.
Absolutely.
And it was, you know, it's upsetting because, you know, I think voters were misled. They were told it's a mansion tax. It is, they were said, we're going to go after the millionaires and billionaires in the Pacific Palisades and Brentwood, and we're going to, you know, they're going to pay their fair share with this tax. People didn't understand that it was all real estate, that it was going to actually make their rents go up because new housing wouldn't get built. And then I think, look, in the business community, and Andrew, this is on you and me and others, we did not do a good job of fighting it. We were all asleep at the wheel. It happened very quickly, as you know, and it's a real problem. And even, you know, Santa Monica's got its own version of the mansion tax. And, you know, the Santa Monica, which is considered a liberal community generally, quite liberal, they actually have a ballot initiative on for the fall being led by the former mayor to exempt multifamily housing from the mansion tax because they've realized people can't build new housing if they do it. So our hope is that this gets reformed. There's some state ballot initiative that would abrogate it. There's talk of next year potentially doing some sort of, you know, local ballot initiative to fix it. But something needs to happen or our housing crisis is going to get worse and our homelessness crisis is going to get worse.
Yeah, the State Taxpayer Protection Act, I believe. And I know you've had events, I believe, at your office. I've had on the podcast the president of the California Business Association. Talk about it. And you're right. It's education. And look, everyone knows about it now. So I think once we get back from summer, it's going to be a full campaign marketing blitz about it. You know, in our remaining minutes, I want you to talk about, if you can, you know, a young person who's, you know, graduating from college today. We're not going to talk about the college campus situation, which we could do a whole another podcast.
Another one on that.
But a recent college grad comes to you and is seeking advice on how to get into the real estate industry today, and what are the differences, I guess, today of someone getting into the business versus when you got into the business, 25 years ago?
Yeah. Look, I think that I can speak to what we look for, right? We want people that, you know, obviously want them to be smart and good work ethic and some experience of that on the resume, but really want people that are passionate about what we're doing. Right. Like it's, you know, at the end of the day, if you like real estate, if you want to be part of improving these communities that we're in, if you like dealing with investors, if you like complexity, right, it's not an easy business that we're in. You know, we look for that kind of passion and energy and intensity. Now, I spent 5 years of my career before I came to CityU in between being a lawyer and and co-founding CityView, I spent 5 years in the entertainment industry, you know, working in the corporate strategy and venture capital group at Warner Brothers, and really interesting and dynamic, and you know, I had people working for me on three continents, and like, and had a great office on the lot. You know, I used to joke around that I would go to the gym on the lot, and literally like treadmill on my right would be Rob Lowe, and on the left would be Jennifer Aniston, you know, because they were filming their shows on the lot. It was a great experience, but I just wasn't passionate about entertainment. You know, I didn't get up in the morning thinking about it. I didn't like reading Variety and Hollywood Reporter. It just didn't do it for me. So I wasn't that good at it. So I moved to a field that I could be passionate about and you know, get up every morning with a spring in my step and go attack it. And so we look for people that have that kind of energy. And I would, you know, I think that's important for people who are thinking about getting in the business. And then, you know, you should definitely, you know your job and get into the details of your job. But, you know, read the newspaper, read the blogs, go out to social events and talk to people. I mean, this is not a business that can be done just sitting in front of your Excel spreadsheet or looking at Google Earth. And I think people forget that sometimes. That's an element of it. And we're definitely data-driven and analytical, but you can't forget this is about, you know, in our business, how people live their lives, and you want to get out there and I think experience it as much as you can.
Yeah, well, I think what you just said really resonates. As I'm on your website right now, and I'm going to read what's on the tagline of your website: "Of we transform cities into communities, people into neighbors, and houses into homes." And I think that what that says, it really dovetails with what you just indicated on having passion towards what your profession.
Yeah, look, and as people said, as a benefit of being true, I mean, that line that you just read, I mean, we didn't come up with that in, you know, one afternoon. I mean, that was heavily debated, negotiated, wordsmith, because we really wanted to drill to the core of kind of what we care about and what we mean. And you know, because it, you know, as you know, I mean, you run a very successful law firm and have a great culture, and, you know, culture really matters. And people talk about culture all the time. It's a little bit of a buzzword, but we spent a lot of time and effort thinking about how do we create kind of an esprit de corps and excitement and being mission driven. And, you know, our job is to make money for our investors, and our job is to, you know, create great communities and do a good job for our residents. And our job is to create an opportunity for the people who work here to grow, to develop, to advance, to be proud of what they're doing. And so, you know, we try to capture that a little bit in that kind of mission statement that you read. And, you know, I think it's, you know, I'm proud of what we built and what we do.
Well, look, I know I've known you for a few years, and we do work together and personally socialize. I just want to thank you for coming on to the show. You know, housing is, the number one issue, not just in LA, but around the country. And so, thank you for making a dent into what has become a real societal issue, and I appreciate you know, you coming on to the podcast.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for having me, and I want to say too, thank you for your partnership with us. I mean, we rely on you for strategic advice, legal advice, help on a lot of areas, and it's been wonderful to work with you in the last few years, and look forward to doing it for kind of many years to come.
I appreciate it, Sean. All right, now I got to go win a baseball game against the Rockies.
Oh, let's go.
All right, take care. Thank you.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.